Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Kate Young.
The benefit of the fermentation science really isn't to scientists always. It's really to the people that are fermenting things, like home brewers and craft brewers.
Today on our show, we talk with Dr. Matt Bachman, a biochemist, brewer, and hunter of yeast. We have an interview from Harvest Public Media about a controversial chemical found in the common weed killer, Roundup. And Chef Daniel Orr takes a traditional holiday food in a new direction. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. Mark Chilla's going to start us off with some news. Hey there, Mark.
Hiya, Kate. First up, the Chinese government announced this week that 10 pesticides will soon join the list of toxins the country has banned for use in agriculture. The chemicals will be phased out gradually over the next few years, the last of them by the end of 2022. In April of this year, Beijing changed their rules on a total of 32 pesticides, outright banning 22 of them for use on food crops. China's Ministry of Agriculture is trying out subsidies for biological pesticides that are less harmful to humans. Analysts have speculated that China may be motivated by a desire for better alignment with the European Union to ease trade between the two economies. And nearly 30% of all U.S. agriculture exports go to NAFTA partners. That's Mexico and Canada. So senators in ag-heavy states are worried NAFTA renegotiations could jeopardize billions in exports. Harvest Public Media's Erica Hunzinger has more.
President Trump wants to make changes to the two-decade-old trade agreement that he says would benefit the U.S. 18 senators, Democrats and Republicans from Arizona to Arkansas, have asked the Commerce Secretary to analyze how any change to NAFTA could affect agribusiness. Kansas Republican Senator Jerry Moran says everyone in his state would feel the pain if the U.S. pulled out of NAFTA entirely.
We are in a time in which commodity prices are terribly low. The last thing that we need is less ability to sell.
Laura Carlson focuses on the impacts of U.S. trade for the Center for International Policy. She spoke with Harvest Public Media via Skype and says the U.S. stands to lose the most due to its reliance on exporting commodities like corn to Mexico.
I think they want to keep NAFTA open the way it is. They don't want to see changes.
Another round of negotiations is expected in early 2018. Erica Hunzinger, Harvest Public Media.
You can find these stories on our website, eartheats.org. There's also a story there from Taylor Killo on restorative agriculture and the role of soil health in climate change. And that's all I got for you today, Kate.
Thanks for that, Mark. We'll see you next week.
Sure thing.
Glyphosate is a controversial ingredient in the popular weed killer Roundup. Several lawsuits allege that the chemical causes cancer, though a recent scientific journal article says there is no statistically significant tie. Meanwhile, Monsanto, which makes the weed killer, has joined several agricultural groups to sue California over warning labels about cancer on Roundup. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Ann Knigendorf spoke with author Carrie Gillum about her new book on glyphosate.
Glyphosate is indeed the world's most widely used agrochemical. In historic quantities, we have been basically dousing our farm fields and parks and playgrounds and lawns and gardens and golf courses with this chemical since roughly 1974.
Okay, so you write that the lawsuits, which began in 2015, will most likely eventually rival those lawsuits over DDT, asbestos, and PCBs. You really think it'll reach those heights?
So if you talk to, you know, lawyers and independent observers and others, they do feel very strongly, and the evidence is pointing to the fact that this could be very similar to what we've seen in the tobacco industry, for example, and with PCBs and asbestos and others, because those are all examples where giant industry corporations, you know, proclaim their products to be safe over and over and over again for decades. We have thousands of people that have sued Monsanto and millions of you know, pages of documents that have been turned over through discovery. And just from what we've seen revealed so far, the internal memos and emails and reports from Monsanto indicate, you know, a real effort to deceive the public for many, many, many years and to manipulate the science and to cover up evidence of dangers associated with this chemical.
Okay, and what are the lawsuits alleging?
They all allege that Roundup caused them or their loved ones to suffer from non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
You mentioned glyphosate in people's urine. What does that indicate exactly?
The reason that it is in our body, that it is apparent in human urine.
In everyone's, right?
Well,
pretty much.
If you have it checked.
Yeah.
Is because we're consuming food that contains glyphosate residues. It's not only sprayed on genetically modified crops, it's also sprayed directly on wheat shortly before harvest, directly on oats before harvest, directly on barley and other things. And then it's used, in production of, citrus crops, oranges and almonds and, tea, tobacco. So the residues are quite commonly found in food production. And that's how it gets transferred generally into our own bodies. Now, Monsanto and the chemical industry says no big deal. The fact that it's in your urine, they say, is a good thing because it means it's getting flushed out of your body. And so that's nothing to worry about.
Are the health problems that are starting to come out from these pesticides and herbicides going to cause something on the scale of the health problems caused by people using tobacco products or the obesity epidemic or other things like that that the taxpayer ends up picking up the bill for?
Well, if you look at, rising rates of cancer in our country and childhood diseases and autism and ADHD, neurodevelopmental problems, you could say we're not waiting for it. I mean, it's already here. And the World Health Organization, the United Nations, the American Medical, like all of these expert organizations in health and wellness and environment, even the EPA agree that pesticides, which are considered environmental contaminants, pesticides are contributing to a range of health problems and disease and rising cancer rates and autism and ADHD and other problems. Where it gets tricky is trying to identify one pesticide and tied to one particular disease.
So what can I do today to protect my kids and to protect them down the road?
I think the answer is different for everybody. You need to have the information and then you need to decide what's important for yourself. And if you want to avoid pesticides at all costs and just do your best to have a diet that's free of that, the only real answer right now is either grow it yourself or buy organic because that's certified and they have to be very careful about things that they use in production. Some people choose to just, wash their fruits and veggies really good because we know that those carry a lot of residues of chemicals. It's a good idea to talk to your, school board or your city council and say, hey, do we really need this stuff sprayed in our parks where my kids play? Do we really want this on the golf course? It's a good idea to write to your lawmaker if you're concerned. It depends on your level of concern and the level of involvement engagement that you want.
That was writer Carrie Gillum speaking with Harvest Public Media contributor Anne Kniggendorf. Gillum's new book is called Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And it's published by Island Press. Support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personal financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Next, we head into the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr. We're making a Hanukkah favorite today, latkes, also known as potato pancakes. So these are traditionally made from shredded potatoes, seasoned with salt and pepper, sometimes chives, almost always some parsley thrown in there. But as he is known to do, Chef Daniel Orr will be taking a detour from tradition. These latkes are made with his own homegrown sweet potatoes.
So we're going to use some of these little guys. And I'm just going to use a box grater, which is your basic cheese grater that most people have at home. And I'm just going to rub these sweet potatoes against it and shred them. This is going to give us probably about 2 cups of grated potatoes. We're using about 1 pound of sweet potatoes. Now, we're going to also make this a little different by adding some different ingredients. We're going to make these curried. So I love curry with a little bit of sweetness, and that's what the sweet potatoes do, is they add that nice flavor to it. All right, so I'm done grating those. Throw those in a nice big mixing bowl, and I'm going to add the remaining ingredients. Instead of regular flour, I'm using chickpea flour. So 1/2 cup of chickpea flour, 2 teaspoons of sugar. You could add honey if you didn't want to use white sugar. I'm going to also add 1 teaspoon of brown sugar. That gives it that molasses kind of flavor. We're going to add some baking powder, about 1 teaspoon. That's going to allow them to rise a little bit and not be so dense. I've got some cayenne pepper, which is our nice spicy pepper. And that's really to taste. I would say about 1/4 teaspoon. Curry powder, 2 teaspoons. Some cumin seeds, about 1 teaspoon. We've got 2 large eggs. That's going to be our binder. It's going to make everything come together. The buttermilk we put in there already, 1/2 cup. And we're going to season it with some salt and pepper. I'm just going to mix that together. If you want to make these ahead, you want to make these ahead and go ahead and fry them, and then put them out on a piece of absorbent paper, and then refrigerate them, and then you can reheat them. But if you make this potato mixture ahead, a lot of times it will darken and it won't be as appealing. The same thing if you use regular potatoes. If you decide you don't want to use sweet potatoes, go ahead and use regular potatoes. But again, you need to cook them as soon as you make this mixture. We're going to take them over to the stove. We're going to cook them in a decent amount of oil. We're going to put about 1/4 inch of frying oil in, heat it up until it's barely smoking, and then we're going to drop the batter in and flatten it out. And we want to cook them over about medium-high heat until they're golden and cooked through the center.
Now, if you're worried about all that oil, don't. Keep in mind, it's the holiday season. Maybe we can allow ourselves a few indulgences. Furthermore, in this case, the oil is significant. One of the reasons that latkes are traditional for Hanukkah is because they're fried in oil. And oil is an important piece of the whole Hanukkah story. The miracle of the oil lamp in the temple, the 8 nights. If you're Jewish, you probably know the story, and I'll refrain from further botching it here. If you aren't Jewish and you don't know the story, go ahead and look it up. So the problem I've always had making latkes comes at the frying stage. It's tricky, trying to keep them from sticking, getting them brown and crispy on the outside and cooked through in the middle. Let's listen to Chef Orr at the frying pan. I get the feeling he knows what he's doing.
Our pan is nice and hot. You want to make sure that your pan is hot before you add your oil. It's very important. Don't put oil in a cold pan because your food will still stick. All right. So what you want to do is to heat up your pan. What that does is the metal expands and it exposes all the surface area of the pan. Whereas if you put the oil in cold, not all the metal is exposed, and that's why food sticks. Even if you put it in a cold pan and then heat it up. All right, so we're gonna add our oil. You can see it's kind of dancing on top of the pan. Now we're going to flap those on. I'm gonna turn the heat down just a little bit, and we're going to make these cakes about the size of a slider bun, you know, but flattened, probably about 2 inches in diameter, I would guess. And this recipe makes about 16 latkes. Nudge them with the back of a spatula, and just to encourage them not to stick. All right, I'm going to turn this heat back up. These guys are all, see how they're all just kind of dancing as I shake the pan? That's a good sign. It means that nobody's being belligerent. Everyone's doing like they're supposed to. Nice and brown.
Yeah, those are perfectly browned.
Definitely no ornery latkes there. They're all sliding off.
Okay, I'm just going to pat them down, congratulate them. And now that they've been flipped, I'm just going to sprinkle a little salt on them. It's important to do that salt while they're still hot, because that way the salt will adhere. So you need to season any of your fried foods while they're still hot. Okay, the second side, we're going to probably cook them for another probably 2.5-3 minutes, medium-high heat. We want them to get make sure that they're cooked in the center. Move them around so they encourage them not to get stuck. And usually once you make that first little adjustment, then they're fine, just like any other pancake. We're going to put a little bit of apple butter in the center in a nice little dish. Serve it with a little bit of sour cream on the side. And those are our curried sweet potato latkes.
Give these latkes a try. The sweet potato and curry seasoning work exceptionally well together. If you don't like them or you're left craving the traditional version, make some of those too. You've got 8 nights to work with. As always, you'll find the recipe online, eartheats.org. Sour beer. Are you a fan? Did you even know sour beer was a thing? Either way, you'll learn more about it in this next interview. Dr. Matt Bachman is a professor of biochemistry at Indiana University. He spoke with IU anthropologists and food scholars Lee Bush and Maddie Chera about his work with yeast. Maddie Chera gets us started.
Dr. Bachman, could you tell us a little bit about your research?
So I'm mostly a biochemist, I guess, if I had to put a title on myself.
Okay.
And my lab does a lot of research on DNA replication and repair. So the types of things that go wrong that end up giving people cancer or other bad diseases. But we use yeast as our model organism to ask and answer lots of questions in biology. And so it's sort of a natural extension of my lab and my hobby. And that's where the fermentation science came in.
Dr. Bachman does research with yeast in his lab, and he also has a business called Wild Pitch Yeast, which we'll hear more about.
I moved here to Indiana 2013, summer of 2013, and pretty soon after that started to go yeast hunting for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a collection of hundreds of mostly local, mostly all, you know, Indiana born and raised yeast strains in the freezer in the lab now. And they've got all sorts of interesting, what a scientist might call phenotypes or what a drinker might just call flavors. and we've got ones that make beer sour and ones that make beer smell like tropical drinks and taste like strawberries and everything in between. And the reason people haven't used these before is basically because of industrialization of beer. You know, back in the day, it was standardized like everything else that if you use these strains, you'll get a consistent product. And you'll always be able to crank out that batch of beer and take it to market. But I think probably historically the types of strains we're really rediscovering were probably pretty common in Europe and elsewhere in whether it was beer or mead or your favorite fermented beverage.
If you take yeast from one place and use it to brew a beer in another place, so say you have a yeast from Germany and you bring it to Bloomington, will the local yeasts take over, or will you be able to preserve the flavors that you brought from the other place?
So most brewers, and that's, you know, 99% of craft brewers and 100% of, you know, macros,
mm-hmm.
They're all using, well, no, I shouldn't say all, but basically all using European origin strains. So these are things that, you know, came from Germany, from, you know, where lagers were invented, or they're British ale strains or something like that. And they do single culture brewing. So all they're putting in the beer is this particular yeast. And if it's the Coors yeast, you know, it's locked in a vault somewhere and only the Coors people can get to it. And so, yeah, it's that same flavor characteristic or aromatic characteristic or whatever fermentation character they're looking for from that strain, batch after batch after batch. But there are breweries that do what's called open fermentation, and literally, you know, the tank is open to the air. And so they may inoculate it with their favorite strain, but then Mother Nature is going to sprinkle things in there too. And then really it's just a race to see who can use up all of those natural resources in the beer. Brewing strains are really, really good. They've been selected over hundreds and thousands of years of brewing to eat sugar really quick. And so I would tend to think they'd probably dominate cultures like that. But Mother Nature's come up with some pretty hardy creatures too, so you never know what's going to get in there and do some fun things.
Bachman's work involves collaborating with Indiana craft brewers collecting yeast strands for brewing. They call it a bioprospecting, or yeast hunting. They're looking for wild yeast with desirable brewing characteristics. They brew test batches of beer and conduct sensory analysis of the final products. They also provide yeast consulting, banking, and lab services, and they've worked with several local breweries and distilleries.
So it seems like one of the ways that you do this is you engage with the public in order to get some of these yeast strains through citizen science and working with homebrewing communities.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between crowdsourced information and your institutionalized research and I guess also your business?
Yeah. Those are all good questions. So, I mean, a lot of science ends up being sort of out of the public eye, you know, whether it's because people just can't understand it because scientists feel the need to use jargon that nobody can swim through, even their colleagues who are just in a slightly different field, or they publish in a journal that's not open access. And so, you know, unless you're at an institution with a subscription, you can't get to it. But the benefit of the fermentation science really isn't to scientists always. It's really to the people that are fermenting things, like home brewers and craft brewers. So I've really tried to make this as accessible to the people that might want it as I possibly can. So I'll archive copies of the papers on my lab website and put them on ResearchGate, and we started putting them on BioArchive. And so as long as you've got an internet connection, you can get to the data.
Oh, that's great.
We have funded some of this by crowdfunding it. You know, the NIH doesn't want to give me money to make beer, and so we've had to come up with other ways to fund some of the research. And, you know, we had, I think it was 60 backers on one of our projects to look at the sour beer microbiome, which was really great. And everywhere from just my mom throwing in a couple of dollars to craft brewers to people that just think fermentation's neat. I have spun out some of this into a business, Wild Pitch Yeast, to try to sell some of these yeast strains we're finding to interested people. Ideally, once we get Wild Pitch Yeast really up and running and rolling, you know, you'd be able to buy a collection kit where you can, like I said, go to your backyard or your favorite place outside and find some things and send them in, and we'll tell you what yeasts are out there and be able to return them to you to make your own beer.
So you've mentioned before that you've had to train your nose and taste buds for describing the beers that you produce, partly because citizens will give different yeast strains to you, and then after you isolate and brew with them, you have to tell them what you've created.
Yeah.
What is the process of training your nose and your taste buds to be able to describe beer like?
Yeah, so there's lots of different ways to do this, and you know, UC Davis has a great sort of sensory program, right? This is all sensory analysis, and you basically train yourself on known samples. You know, for instance, if you want to do sensory analysis of beer, you know, beer has malted barley in it and hops, for instance. So you can train yourself on what common hop flavors or hop aromas are, so that if you're given a blind sample, then you can pick up on, you know, what that chemical is, whether it's in your nose or in your mouth, and say, oh, okay, that's a hop essence I'm getting at, or that's what malty is considered as a flavor. And so some of it's just really, you know, as a beer drinker, you're used to these flavors. Now let's put some terminology into it. The hard part is when you get something that doesn't taste like a normal beer, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, wait a minute, that's super familiar. What is that? And that's where a sensory panel, a number of people getting involved, is really handy. So somebody's like, oh, that's strawberry. And then that clicks in your head. That's exactly right. But strawberry is so far from my normal understanding of beer that my brain was having trouble connecting the two.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what sour beers are and what developments you've made?
Yeah, especially why they have to be kept separate.
Yeah. So sours are traditionally or generally maybe soured with bacteria. And the bacteria make lactic acid, and that's what gives it that tart, sour flavor. And if somebody's making an IPA or a brown ale or a quote-unquote normal beer, you don't want it to be sour. You don't want it to be tart. That's considered an off flavor.
In Bloomington, a local brewery called Upland recently built a separate building to produce their sour beers.
So for Upland, before they actually had a separate facility in the wood shop to make sour beer, when they were doing everything in the same place at the same time, they were probably sweating bullets, right? Because if you get one bacterium in a batch of Dragonfly IPA, that's enough to ruin the whole batch, and you don't want to dump that down the drain. And bacteria are smaller than yeast, and so they can get in the nooks and crannies of all the brewing equipment, and they're really hard to clean out. And so even with really good cleaning procedures, it just takes one cell to ruin the next batch. And so that's why people usually make them in separate facilities, or they just focus on sour beer or clean beer, and they won't mess with the other one because they don't want to deal with the headaches. Our sort of most recent claim to fame, I guess, is that we found yeast, pure culture yeast, that will also sour beer. And you can kill the yeast the same way you could kill any other brewing strain. So, you know, Upland might use a California ale yeast and a Belgian ale yeast and a German Hefeweizen strain to make three different beers, but they don't worry about cross-contamination because they know they've got cleaning procedures that kill those yeast. Mm-hmm. And these things you can kill the same way. So you can technically now make sour beer and clean beer in the same facility without having to worry or go nuclear when you're cleaning things.
And I know we have two fairly new cider makers in town. Is that something that yeast gets involved with as well?
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes these mead makers and cider makers and sizer makers and kombucha makers and whatever it might be, it's really the same strains that everybody uses if you're at a winery or a distillery or whatever. And so I was down at Friendly Beasts the other day, the new cidery, and introduced myself and left them my card and told them we work with local weird stuff, and they seemed excited about that. So, hopefully we'll be able to get involved with more people.
That was IU biochemist Dr. Matt Bachman talking with Lee Bush and Maddie Chura of the IU Food Institute. Next week on our show, we'll talk with the owners of that new cider place Bachman mentioned. Friendly Beasts. It's part of a new series here on Earth Eats called Making the Leap. We'll be focusing on what it takes to get started with a new food business, or in this case, a new beverage business. So be sure to tune in for that next week, right here on Earth Eats. Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Maddie Chera, Lee Bush, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. We'll see you next week.